We just finished the Lord's Supper. Such a powerful moment, both in that time and in this one. And I think it will be a powerful time in the future as well. But that's forthcoming, hopefully soon. They end by singing a song. It could have been any number of psalms. Nevertheless, we could probably narrow it down to at least five or six. The Hallel Psalms of Psalm 113 through 118 were consistent staples in the time of Passover. However, at the end of Passover, normally what is sung is Psalm 136. And we sung that at the end of class yesterday, where you have this consistent phrase of His love endures forever being stated over and over and over. Literally every other phrase, not even every other sentence, His love endures forever. His love endures forever. And I think it'd be not only appropriate for them to be singing that around this time, but it's something they're going to need to have ringing through their ears over the next several verses. Because the disciples, about what they're about to experience, is not what they would have defined as love enduring forever. For even in the middle of that psalm, you see a distinct moment in which it starts reliving the Exodus account. And not only reliving the Exodus account, but even calling for God to once again liberate them in the same way He did under the Egyptians. And that's exactly what the disciples would have been looking for. They're looking for a violent revolution. Why? Because that's what the Jewish expectation was at this time. They were looking for a messianic figure like Judas Maccabeus, like the Maccabean revolt of the 2nd and 1st century BC, to come in and to stink and kick the tails of the enemies. Just knock them out. Exalt Israel, have God reigning from Yahweh, and ultimately having the exiles return back to their land. So when Jesus is leading them in a hymn of His love endures forever, be pretty important, because these next 3-4 days are going to be, well, I say 3-4 days, 2-4 days, will be quite dark, very confusing, and looking for love that will help them endure, and possibly even forever. So we are in Mark chapter 14, verse 27. After they're singing this hymn, this psalm, two words trying to fight out of my mouth at one time. After they finish singing this psalm of victory, Jesus ends it, this awesome refrain of His love endures forever, with, "You will all fall away." That's what He says. Oh man, you got to think through the eyes of Peter over these next several verses. Man. Those words right there for Peter must have been ringing pretty loud and clear. Peter's going to have a rough go over the next several verses. For not only is he going to be proving to be not suffering from insomnia in any way, shape, or form here in a moment, but he's also going to be whipping out a knife here pretty soon, or a sword, and cutting off somebody's ear. He's also going to be fleeing and leaving Jesus, denying Him several times. Peter's going to have a rough go here pretty soon. And so when Jesus looks at him and says, "You will fall away," man, Peter must be thinking through all the gunk we're going to be tracing in a moment and saying, that initial time he said this, I remember what I felt. And yet he was right, because he knew what lens I was looking through. He knew what lens I was looking through. "You will all fall away," Jesus told them, "for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." That comes from Zechariah 13, verse 7. Jesus is a big fan of Zechariah, if you've noticed here in this last week or so. Zechariah 9 is what was directly referenced in the blood of the covenant language during the Lord's Supper. Zechariah 9 is even what is referenced as He is coming in through the triumphal entry at the beginning when He is on a donkey. Zechariah 13 here, verse 7, is a pretty important passage as well, because of what happens in Zechariah 13, 8 and 9. Zechariah 13, 8 through 9 says, "In the whole land, declares the Lord, 2/3 will be struck down and perish. Yet 1/3 I will be left in. 1/3 will be left in it. This third I will bring into the fire. I will refine them like silver and test them like gold. They will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is our God." See, Zechariah 13, 8 through 9 is very important, because what verse 7 introduces is that God is going to be, in a sense, allowing His people to be judged. And yet out of those people, a new people be created that He will use to liberate and bring redemption. You see how that makes sense in what Jesus is doing here? while it looks like that whenever the sheep is struck and the shepherd is struck and the sheep scatter, while that looks like destruction, Jesus is saying actually that's what God will use to bring about liberation. It's his message of victory through suffering. It's what we've been talking about since chapter 8 at least. That the Son of Man will be betrayed and handed over to the chief priest, and he will be killed. He will be beaten and crucified. Although he doesn't say that. Technically he says killed. And in 3 days will be raised. And he says it 7, 8 times after that, and they still don't get it. And he's still saying that same message by the Old Testament passages he's referencing. Zechariah 13:7 says, no, the shepherd will be destroyed. And the sheep will scatter. You will all fall away. But if you keep reading in Zechariah 13, verses 8 and 9, you realize that that is still the plan through which God will bring redemption. Creation of a new people. Liberation. Well, what Psalm 136 was singing about, just with different definitions that they were not comfortable with. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. That actually is true. That's what happens. Matthew chapter 28. Where is the Great Commission being pronounced from? I know this isn't Matthew class, but you can take a guess. Galilee. Right? It's kind of interesting that Jesus leaves his Galilean ministry way back in chapter 10. He will not get back there at all while he is still pre-Easter. I don't know how to even say that. I can't say the word living because he is living. He will not go back to Galilee, but Galilee will bring the full circle of his ministry. For whenever he reaches them once again in Galilee, when he presents himself in the resurrection in Galilee, you will know that the kingdom has been established. What he pronounces in Mark chapter 1, verse 15 will come to fruition once he once again revisits Galilee after his crucifixion and resurrection. And that's what we find in Matthew 28 actually occurring. That's what I think people try to express in the longer ending of Mark, which we will talk about in next week. Well, kind of. We'll talk about it in as much as I think it needs to be talked about. How's that one for you? Okay, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Peter declared, even if all fall away, I will not. Who declared that? Peter. The guy whose memories are being recorded. I mean, picture that moment whenever Peter's speaking to the Christians in Rome, who they themselves maybe even have said the very same thing to you whenever they very first start following Jesus. Even if all fall away, I'll never fall away. It's kind of like sitting here right now. And I know some of you right now, even the fact you've come to Ozark, you've said, Lord, I'm giving everything up for you, and I will fight for you, and I will never leave you. And yet in 10 years from now, some of the people that are sitting in this room will be the ones possibly that are caught in infidelity. Some of the people in this room could be the ones that not only just walk away from ministry, but maybe even walk away from the faith. And Paul's sitting in a room of Roman Christians who have had their friends along with them say, even if I'll fall away, I will never fall away. And yet they look around the room and they see an empty spot where they say, he said it too, and now he's not here. Why? Because things are a little rough in Rome right now. And Peter says, man, I've said that too. I remember the moment whenever Jesus pronounced that the shepherd's head would be struck and all the sheep would be scattered. And I looked back at him and he said, even if I'll fall away, I will never fall away. I said that, Peter. And even 30 years after this event in the 60s when Peter's recounting this, I'm sure that the wounds of that moment are just as deep. Even though he's experienced redemption, even though he has been restored and now is a pillar of the church, you can still hear the pain in Peter's voice whenever he says, even if all fall away, I will never abandon you. Why? Because what is Peter's lens when he's saying this? What is he thinking? He's thinking, hey, Jesus, in this bloody revolution, if you get struck down, I'll be there getting struck down with you. Because I'm fighting with you to the death. I'm there, man. Even if all run away from you in this battle, in this war that we're about to start, because Passover's coming to an end, and we know what that means. Liberation's a coming. Even if all abandon you, I've got my sword. He's packing. It will show that in just a minute. Even if all fall away, I won't. Even if it looks like all the odds are against us, if there's an entire contingency of Roman soldiers as well as Jewish ones, and we are the only 12 that are there fighting, and you get struck down, I will get struck down with you. I will fight to the death. And Jesus looks at him and says, you don't get it. There will be death, but it'll all be on me, not you, and not you taking the life of someone else. That's not the way my kingdom advances. Even if all fall away, Peter declares, I will never abandon you. I will fight in this bloody revolution to the death. Verse 30, I tell you the truth, Jesus answered. Today, yes, actually tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times. How is that possible? How is it possible to go from at one extreme saying, I will fight with you in the bloody revolution to the death, all the way to denying Jesus three times? How is that possible? Because Peter gets disenchanted with Jesus whenever Jesus doesn't follow the things he expects him to do. That makes sense. Peter will follow Jesus if he fits his lens. But if Jesus violates Peter's lens, violates what Peter expects of the Messiah, violates what Peter demands of this relationship, then it'll be very easy for him to abandon Jesus. And if you can't make that practical application in your own life, check your pulse. Because my word, how often do people walk away from the ministry or walk away from Christianity as a whole because Jesus doesn't fit their lens? He didn't give me what I wanted him to give me. He didn't do what I wanted him to do. It happens all the time. You will be ministering to people and you yourself will be tempted to it. I'm telling you right now, things will happen in your life that you don't expect and that you don't think is fair and that you think Jesus should have done differently. And my response back is, that's not your call. Remember who you are. Remember who he is. It's not your call. You don't get to tell him that he's done something wrong. It's why I don't know any other arrogance than behind this statement. Well, why didn't God just create a world when there wasn't any evil at all? That just seems to me to make the better sense. And I just want to look at him and say, you are really, really arrogant. Why? Because literally what you're saying is that the almighty, all-knowing, all-powerful God that is all good hasn't come up with a better plan than what you have been able to come up with. Oh, he didn't even think of that. He just thought, you know what? I've got to have evil. I'm addicted to it. And in your finite wisdom, you've come up with the solution that he just missed it. Well, that's novel. I wish I would have had you in the beginning and then we wouldn't have been in this mess. Come on. If he really is who he says he is, a lot of our objections, a lot of our questions become absolute folly in light of his identity. A lot of times we just don't believe who he is. You want to know an apologetic principle? I have never heard an objection to Christianity that wasn't in some way connected to the rejection of a part of God's identity. Every one of them. Problem of evil, they don't believe he's all good or that he's all powerful, but really all good's the issue. Every objection to Christianity can be attached to the identity of God that someone refuses to believe. And you want to overcome these objections? Stop arguing with the objections and keep showing them who Jesus is. It's very simple. I don't know did I talk about this somewhat yesterday? The question is not the why, it is the who. I was talking to a boy, and he was like 11, and he was at the Revelation seminar I did a couple weekends ago. And we have a question-answer time, because I love question-answer times. Because we have to talk about everything, the whole Bible. We just get to talk about whatever we want. And he brought up the question of evil in the world. Why didn't God just create the world without Satan? And I didn't look at him and say, you arrogant little punk. I didn't say that. I said, you know, after the tornado in Joplin, I've been answering that question a lot. Why did God do this? Why did God do this? Why did he let this happen? It's usually phrased in different ways. Let this happen. They don't want to totally put the blame on him, yet they are. Or why did he do this? They're putting all the blame on him. Same thing. And I looked at him and I said, and guess what? We can never answer the why question. Because I don't know. I don't know if this was just the natural occurrences of the world in which this just kind of happened. I don't know if it was Satan's responsibility. I don't know if God did. I don't know who did it. But what I do know is this. I know the one about whom you're talking about. I can answer the question of who God is. I can't answer the question why things happen. I don't know why they happen. But if I trust who he is, the why question becomes unimportant. It just really isn't important. Because if I believe that God is all-powerful and that he is working everything out for his good and that he'll use both Satan's power against Satan and he'll use his own power to bring about his ultimate glory, if I know that he is all good, that he is the God that is even willing to take upon death himself, that if he is, like we talked about with Austin, the creator that became the created to serve the creation, if he is all those things, if that is who he is, then I don't need an answer to the question of why. Because frankly, every answer to the question why I've ever gotten in a moment of suffering has made things worse. They're stupid answers. Like in the time of our miscarriage, I had a guy come up to me and say, well, you know why this happened? He's going to answer the why question for me. Why? Because something better is going to happen. And I looked at him and I said, I didn't say. I wanted to say. Please, sir, tell me. What is more important or what is better than my child living? That's all I want to know. If you can explain that to me, then I'll buy into your ridiculous theology. But to sit there and say that an answer to the why is that something better is coming is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Don't answer the question why, answer the question who. That is always more effective in times of grieving. Because the why question is what Job was obsessed with. And what did God tell him? Shut up. You need to know who I am. That's all that's important. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? What's implicit in that question? Who am I? And who are you? Have you seen the heavenly, you know, storehouses laden with snow? Have you seen those? No, I have. Oh, where were you whenever I called forth the Leviathan and the Behemoth? Where were you when I put all the cosmos into order? What is he saying? Who am I? And if you know who I am, then your why questions, you realize, are futile. They're worthless. They don't even mean anything. I'm wearisome of the why question because it produces no fruit at all in my own soul or anybody else's. I understand that's a natural reaction for all of us in times of grieving. But the who is the only answer that'll actually get you beyond your grieving. And if you reject the who, a lot of times you'll move into a time of embitterment and it'll destroy your whole life. So, in times of grieving, asking the question of who is important. And the problem with Peter is he's not accepting the who. Jesus says, this is who I am. No, you're going to lead a bloody revolution because that's what messiahs do. And Jesus says, but that's not who I am. And Peter says, if you don't, I'll deny you. And he does. How can you move from dying in a bloody revolution to denial? You reject who Jesus claims to be. I'll tell you the truth, Jesus answered. Today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times. But Peter insisted emphatically. Oh, gosh. Even if I have to die with you, Jesus, I will never disown you. And all the others said the same. Now, I know we're beating up on Peter's son, but you got to remember how Peter dies. Crucified upside down, being pulled away from his wife, and looking at her and saying, remember the Lord. So it's redeemable. Nevertheless, rejection of who Jesus is always painful. Verse 32, they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to the disciples, sit here while I pray. He took Peter, James, and John, the inner three, along with him. This is not the first time the inner three has got to be in a special situation with Jesus, is it? What are the other times so far that the inner three have been designated as experiencing something that the others have not? Transfiguration is the go-to. We'll talk about that one in a moment. What's the other one before that? Jairus' daughter. They're the only ones that get to experience the resurrection of her. Which should in some sense tie a lot of this together. You know, that death, because of who Jesus is, will bring life. Ultimately because of who he is transfigured to be on the mountain. You know, the inner three in Mark's gospel are also the ones, in Matthew's gospel he expands it to more than just the inner three, all the disciples. But in Mark's gospel, the inner three are the ones that also ask the question about the destruction of the temple and the end of the age. And Jesus, really, if you look at those, the three times at the inner three before this point, get to experience something special in Mark's gospel, it encompasses all that Christ is in his first coming all the way through his second coming. All of it. All three of these. The resurrection of a girl, the transfiguration on the mountain, as well as the second coming distinction. The inner three experience all that. And now, this inner three is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And they've been on a mountain before with Jesus and saw him transfigured into something that is glorious. But on this mountain, they will watch Jesus be transformed into something of a mess. The inner three, along with Jesus, go up on the mountain. And he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. The language there is pretty fascinating to me because it is almost directly, linguistically, almost a direct quote of Psalm 42:5. Linguistically. Psalm 42:5 says, "Why are you downcast, O my soul?" But the Greek, although it's reoriented in its composition, it's the same word, same terminology. But let me read Psalm 42:5, really through verse 11. "Why are you downcast, O my soul? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God." And then verse 9 it says, "I say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Why must I go about mourning, oppressed by my enemy? My bones suffer mortal agony as my foes taunt me, saying to me all the day long, where is your God?" What does that sound like? I don't know, if you flip a page in your Bible, you'll probably at least hit the chapter it sounds like. Where is your God? Oh, if you're the Son of God, can't you save yourself? Keep reading Psalm 42. It says, "Why are you downcast, O my soul?" Verse 11. "Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise Him, my Savior and my God." Do you hear what he says? I love the Psalms that are quoted in Mark's Gospel over the last 2-3 chapters. Because every one of them is about being in a moment of abandonment, a moment of absolute distress, a moment when it looks like God Himself has walked away. And it says, "And yet in the midst of that, I will never walk away. Because I know who He is. Because He is my God. And I will put my trust in Him. In the who, not in the why. Because you can't explain to me why I'm being surrounded by my enemies. In a way in which it makes me go, oh, okay, now I get it, and now I'm good to go. The why question will never bring you comfort. But the who, it may even lead you to carry your own cross. Why so disturbed within me? And yet, I will praise Him. I will put my hope in God, for He is my Savior and my God. Stay here and keep watch. Verse 35. Going a little further, Jesus fell to the ground and prayed that if possible, the hour might pass from Him. What does that do for you? What strikes you about that? Or does it? Is that just ho-hum? Just something Jesus says? It's not red letters, so it doesn't really matter as much to me, Shane. Okay, I understand. Red letters are better. Yeah.
which, I mean, it's not bad, but at the same time, you kind of want him to love you in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it is bothersome on some level. What? Why is it bothersome? I mean, because it's almost like, why doesn't he want to do that? Well, I mean, what is it that you want him to do? I want you to be beaten to a pulp. I want you to be hanging on a tree, even though you didn't do anything. That's what I want you to do. I think it's bothersome also because in this moment, we probably see Jesus' humanity on display and more than any other moment throughout the entire narrative. And a lot of the times, the who of Jesus, we don't always want him to be human. Which I know that's weird, because in our culture, most of them don't want him to be God. Men in our own lives, we just don't want him to be human, and yet we do. But whenever he expresses his humanity, it does become, I think the word is right, bothersome. There's a turmoil in me. Whenever I'm going, Jesus struggled. Jesus struggled. Jesus sneezed. Jesus got the flu. That's weird. It's one of the reasons why the incarnation is just, whoever acts like that it's a simple thing is just, I don't want to say the word dumb, but I want to say the word dumb. The incarnation is psychotic. It is beyond mystery. It is stupid. It doesn't make any sense. And it never will. That the God of all creation can catch a cold? Or that he can be in a moment whenever we need him to be the strongest, and what he shows us is weakness? And he cries out, Abba, Daddy, Father. Abba is a pretty striking word. Joachim Jeremias took this probably a little bit too far. But it is a very unique word that is not very often, actually extremely rare, brought up in any Jewish context, even after the time of Jesus. You just don't. It's an Aramaic word that literally is best translated daddy. It's an intimacy of a little child with his daddy. And that type of intimacy with God is something that a lot of times the Jews would not be comfortable with, because a lot of times they would even use circumlocutive words, words that would get around even saying his name or showing overt intimacy, because they had such a deep reverence for him. And that's something, both of which I think I wish we could regain, as well as something that we get to enjoy, that it doesn't have to be. Does that make sense? A lot of times the Jews, they would even just say, it is, you know, the kingdom of heaven, because they didn't want to say kingdom of God, because it's just, we won't write his name, we don't want to say his name, we want to avoid it, even though everybody knows what we're talking about. That's why Adonai becomes an important word. You can say Adonai, it's more of a generic word for Lord, but you can say it to refer to the one you're talking about without having to actually say the name of the one you're talking about. And yet, in their fear of intimacy with God, Jesus says, Daddy, Father, everything is possible for you. So take this cup from me. Cup has come up two other times in the Gospel of Mark. Where are they? Say it again.
Like the Lord's Supper.
The Lord's Supper. Yeah, the Lord's Supper is the closest one that has come, where he says, this is the cup of my blood that will be poured out for you. Which in that context, the cup is referring to what? Suffering. And the other time is whenever James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come and they say, will you give us whatever we want? He's like, well, what do you want? We want to sit at your right and your left hand when you come into your glory of the kingdom. He's like, can you really drink the cup that I'm going to drink? Be baptized in the baptism I'm going to be baptized with? Oh yeah, sure we can. I definitely can. But he says, oh, you will be. But the right and the left, I can't give that out. That's reserved for God to give out alone. What is cup used in that context? Suffering. Jesus says, Lord, take the suffering from me. Anything is possible for you. And if you are all powerful, then even you can take away what is put before me and do something different. You can do it different. I know you can, because everything is possible for you. Even fitting a camel through the eye of a needle. Everything is possible for you. So take it away. Can't we do this a different way? Yet not what I will, but what you will. Why? Because of who God is. Why does it have to be this way? Yet it doesn't matter to me, because who you are means I will obey whatever you say. Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. Simon, he said to Peter. What's wrong with that? He says, it's not appropriate for me at this time to call you rock. It's just not. But Jesus, I'll go with you even to the death. But that's not what I'm asking you to do. You say you'll go to me to the death, but then you won't even stay awake with me and pray. How can I call you a rock, Simon? I wonder, this is just something that's really come about with all the tornado stuff. I've talked to a lot of people. It's been pretty fascinating. Even people that weren't directly in the tornado here in Joplin will talk about having dreams of the tornado coming, even if they weren't even here in Joplin, but they lived here. For the tornado brought a lot of different types of darkness that plague a lot of different types of people. But one of the key ways is through dreams. People will be in a dream and it's such a traumatic moment for them that they will feel like they're right in the middle of the tornado again, but usually the outcome of it is much more worse than what it actually was. And I wonder how many times Peter was sleeping and he awakes in a cold sweat with the voice of Jesus saying, Simon. I just wonder how many times. Because this is such a traumatic moment. Whenever all Jesus asked him to do was to stay awake with him in the garden while Jesus is literally fighting, jousting with Satan. And he falls asleep. What kind of a rock is that? And I just curious that this traumatic of a moment, I wonder how many times Peter woke up hearing the voice Simon again, thinking he was back in the garden. Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? For 1 hour? You're going to go to the death with me, but you can't even keep watch for an hour. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. That word temptation, where does it throw you back to? What? Mark chapter 1. Where Jesus goes out in the desert for 40 days and is tempted, same word, tempted by Satan. I believe in my heart of hearts that what the Passion did in their depiction of the Garden of Gethsemane was dead on. Passion of the Christ, the movie, Mel Gibson, 5, 6, 7 years ago. Where at the very beginning scene, you see Caviezel in the garden praying, and who's lurking around in the olive trees in Gethsemane? But the creepy looking Satan whispering in Jesus' ear as he's praying, you don't have to do this. You don't have to do this. Bow your knee to me, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world. You want to establish a kingdom? You don't have to do it through the cross. Suffering, man, I can give you a kingdom in which it'll make you all so comfortable. Matter of fact, I'll give you a kingdom that even right before any sort of discomfort comes, I'll just rapture you out. That's the kingdom I can give you, Jesus. Just bow your knee to me. And buddy, we can come together and we can rule this world. So much easier. Matter of fact, Jesus, you want to know? Oh man, there is a powerful depiction. I can't remember what Jesus film it is. There's a powerful depiction that in the times of the temptations, what Satan does to Jesus is he starts taking him throughout history and showing him how the cross is being used by Christians all throughout different time periods. And what you see is he takes him to the time of the Crusades where Christians are carrying their crosses and going and just murdering the Muslims. He says, this is what you're dying for? Or then he jumps forward and it's much more modern war and they all have Christian, you know, emblems on their chest. And he says, this is what you're dying for? Your cross will be used as violence against other people. Don't you think there's a better way? This is what you're going to suffer for? These people are going to spit on your cross. And they're going to use it for whatever they want. So do it my way. It'd be much easier for you, and they're going to do whatever they want anyway. What is happening here? I think it's significant the fact that the disciples will fall asleep and Jesus will have to come to them three times. Because in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 4, verses 1 through 11, there were three go-arounds between Jesus and Satan in the wilderness during the temptations. Three go-arounds, and all three of them had to do with one singular issue. Change who you are. Change your identity. Don't be the suffering Messiah. Be the vicious king. And it's one of the reasons why, in Mark chapter 8, whenever Peter confesses that you are the Christ, and then rebukes Jesus after Jesus says, yeah, you're right, and I have to suffer and die, that in Jesus' rebuke, he looks at Peter and he says, get behind me, Satan. Because what Satan was longing for is the same thing Peter was longing for, and it's the same thing Judas is longing for Jesus to be a different Messiah, one that does not take violence upon himself, but one that exerts violence out in a rapid pace. Much easier for Jesus, just not the plan of God. Keep watch so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak. Once more he went away and prayed the same thing. Prayed what? Father, take this away from me. I don't want to suffer. And you can do anything. You're all powerful. Take this away, but not your will, mine. Not my will, but yours. Although we do pray the other way a lot of the time. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Man, that'd be one of the very first times I think Peter would look at his congregation. He said, in that moment, I was just speechless. We failed them again. And it was so hard. I remember even sitting there and trying to sit myself up against the olive tree, doing whatever I could to stay awake, just saying, okay, Lord, I got to help me stay awake. And the next thing I knew, I'm on the ground and Jesus is shaking me awake again. And he looks at me and he says, why can't you stay awake? And my eyes, even as he's talking, are drooping shut again. And I had nothing to say. Because I know you call me Peter, I just don't always feel like a rock. Returning the third time, he said to them, are you still thinking sleeping and resting? You have no idea what's staring at you in the face right now. I've been telling you. You have no idea that we are on the brink of the kingdom being inaugurated through my suffering. And you're sleeping through it. I mean, this is almost a spiritual commentary on the whole nation of Israel as a whole. Where Jesus comes in his first coming and he finds them sleeping. And he says, but the king is here. And they go back to sleep. And he shakes them awake and they go back to sleep. And Jesus just says, you're addicted to what this world says you need to be addicted to. Personal comfort and violence. And Jesus says, enough. The hour has come. Look, the king, the Son of Man, is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise. Let us go. Here comes my betrayer. The next time we see that word rise, agero, is in Mark chapter 16. Whenever the angel looks at the women and he says, the one you are looking for, Jesus of Nazareth, is not here, for he is risen. I think it's very appropriate that resurrection language finds its way into the Garden of Gethsemane discourse. Because that's where we're headed. Verse 43. Just as he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. And at this moment, the disciples probably would have been shocked. I do not think at this moment the disciples would have gone, there's that dirty snake. I think they would have thought, hey, Judas, what are you doing, Judas? What are you doing? I mean, John chapter 12 tells us the disciples trusted Judas. They looked at him as such a loyal and responsible leader that he was even the treasurer of the group. Why would the disciples be okay with the treasurer of the group being the one they thought was the biggest snake? They see Judas coming, they're like, hey buddy, what's going on? With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priest, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Do I have time to go deep into this? 6 minutes, that's a lot of time. Yeah, let's do it. The word swords is fascinating throughout Matthew's gospel as well as Mark's. And the reason why it's fascinating is because in this moment, the Garden of Gethsemane, more than any other moment, you have a clash not only of kingdoms, but of political agendas. And all of them center and surround around this concept of the sword. What is the sword used for? As a matter of fact, this word sword that's being used this time, and we'll trace in a moment, it's used through Matthew and Mark. But the word sword, I'm acting like I'm going to draw this. The word sword, don't picture a big broadsword. It's not the word being used. It's makaria, which is actually a dagger. And it can be used for close hand-to-hand combat. But it can also be used to carve the animal that you just killed. It's like a Swiss Army knife. It can be used lethally. But it is also a tool with which they use when they were traveling nomadically throughout the countryside. You hear the ambivalence within that term then? The question is, whenever they're coming up, the enemy, with the makario, how are they expecting to use it? But whenever Jesus tells his disciples in Matthew's gospel, take the makario, what's he telling them to use it for? The same thing that they use it for? Or for a tool as you are going to be on your own for at least 3 to 4 days? The word sword here, I think, is really important to trace because it puts the two kingdom agendas in clear juxtaposition. The first time we see it in Matthew's gospel, which we don't have it in Mark's, is when Jesus is talking to his disciples about to send them out on their missionary journey. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 34, Jesus says, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." But here's the problem. How is Jesus using that word, sword, there? What is the sword that doesn't bring peace? Is it made of metal? In that context, you can probably determine what he is saying there without even flipping there. If Jesus says, "For I did not come to this world to bring peace on earth, I came with a sword." What is the sword? The message. It's right in the context of Jesus saying, let me tell you this. When you follow me, your allegiance to me will cause problems between brothers and brothers. It'll cause problems between sisters and sisters. It'll cause problems between children and their parents. Because my message actually divides. It's what it does. That's what the gospel today even still is offensive, I promise. Just say the things that Jesus said and you'll get even punished by the people that are closest to you. Jesus says, I didn't come to bring peace. And my goal is not just to make absolutely everyone on the earth just happy-go-lucky. My goal is for the truth to come in and to make everybody in the world realize that what they're addicted to in this world is actually not reality. And whenever you try to take away from the child the thing that which it believes sustains its entire life, you will not always find peace. You will find fighting back. He says, I'm sorry, my message will tick a lot of people off. I didn't come to bring peace, though. I came to bring a sword. And the sword is the message. Right? In Matthew's gospel, is it not? That's the first time it's used in Matthew's gospel. The next time that we find it used in Matthew's gospel is the same place we find it used here in Mark chapter 14, verse 43. For in Matthew 26, 47, almost the identical phrase in Mark 14, 43, is you see Jesus looking at them and saying, you see the narrator saying, with this the crowd comes armed with swords and clubs. Why are they armed with swords and clubs? They are armed in a fashion that would come to put down a political revolution. A violent political revolution is what this crowd is armed to take care of. They come to find Jesus, who is claiming to be the Messiah at the time of the Passover, and they are armed for a war. A physical, violent war. In both in Mark's gospel as well as Matthew's, that is the second time it is used. But you sit there and you think, wait a minute. But if I look at the first time that the word sword is used, it wouldn't make sense for them to have to attack Jesus like this. Because his sword is not physical, his sword is a message. The next time we find it used, the third time in the Matthew-Mark synopsis, whatever. We'll just play linguistic games and act like we're doing something. Mark chapter 14, verse 47 says, "Then one of those standing near Jesus drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear." That's the third time the word sword is used. And what you have is this. The first time in Matthew's gospel, Matthew 10, Jesus defines the way his word sword is going to be used. The second time you see the word used in Mark as well as Matthew 26, but Mark 14, 43, you see the kingdoms of the world coming and using the word sword in the way in which they think it should be used. Then, the third time you see it is in Mark 14, 47, where one of Jesus' disciples shows that he agrees, not with that, but with this. He uses Makaria to go out and says, "I'm going to use my Makaria the same way the world uses theirs." And he cuts off the ear of Malchus the high priest, or his servant. You see what's happening? You have a war of political agendas all surrounding upon this word for sword. There's actually two other times this word sword is used in Matthew's gospel. Matthew chapter 26, verse 52. After Peter strikes the ear of the high priest's servant, Jesus looks at Peter and says, "Put your sword back in its place." Jesus said to him, "For all who draw the sword will die by the sword." So the fourth time we see this word sword being used is Jesus rebuking the way that both his disciples and the kingdoms of the world have defined the word sword. Because he looks at him and he says, "I'm telling you right now, all that sword that defined that way does is perpetuate more violence. That's all it does. Because whenever you strike off his ear with the sword, guess what? He'll use his sword to do the same thing to you. And over and over and over the spiral goes. The last time the word sword is used is in Mark 14, 48 or Matthew 26, 55, where Jesus looks at them and he says, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me?" He looks at him and he says, "You don't even know who I am." All of you, disciples, Judas, Roman soldiers, you don't even get who I am. Why? Because you think that this is the way we define the word sword. But I'm telling you, this is the way we define the word sword. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. Love you guys. See you then.